All right, we are back to spend just 1 hour today. We're not going to spend our full 2 hours as usual on pantheism. And your homework assignment is to watch the film What the Bleep Do We Know? And that will be part and parcel of your understanding of this worldview. I do want to make one sort of correction, if it is a correction. I kind of forgot those Mormon names yesterday, so I went back and looked them up. It was a Harris that, Martin Harris, who was one of the witnesses to the golden tablets.
He was a witness, so he did see them.
Well, he claims he saw them, but people have criticized his claim because it seems that he saw them in a dream or something like that. In other words, he was such a spiritualist that he didn't feel like he had to bear witness, you know, giving tactile touch. And the other witnesses, too, I think it was Crowder and, is it Quimby? The other guys, they, too, had sort of strange testimonials. So we're not really sure what they saw when they saw. Does that make sense?
Sure.
By the way, all three of these guys got excommunicated at one point. They left the movement and then later in life came back to it. So, they just had a falling out with Joseph Smith, and Smith said that they were mean and beyond redemption or something like that, and it was just a big mess.
They came back later.
Smith was killed in 1844 in a courthouse. He had been arrested, and so that's why the Mormons, they moved. They were in Missouri, I believe, or maybe they were still in Illinois. Anyways, they were moving westward, and Brigham Young took over the movement and moved them out to Utah. That's how they...
By killed, you mean he was executed?
Well, he was in the court. He was in jail, and a mob went in there and killed him.
Well, what were they so mad about?
Well, he had... one of the things that he had done is he had acquired several wives, and some of these women were wives of other men. So that was one problem.
So what did he mean by acquired? Did he force them to marry them?
No, no, he didn't force them, but he kind of seduced them out of their marriages and into a relationship with him. So, you know. That's how, well, it's good to be a prophet. You know what I mean? You can pretty much get the ladies when you're a prophet. Muhammad got the ladies. Joe Smith got the ladies. You know, did you see the movie?
Of course, to turn me into a prophet.
Did you see the movie History of the World Part 1?
No, I didn't.
There's a when they get to the French Revolution, it's Mel Brooks, comic genius. And whenever you see him doing something naughty, he'll look at the camera and he'll say, "It's good to be the king." And so he'll go grope some woman, and then he'll look at the camera and he'll say, "It's good to be the king."
So you mean Joseph Smith is doing the same thing?
Yeah, yeah. He's like, "It's good to be a prophet."
And so in his text, that was glorified to seduce women out of their marriages?
Oh, well, it wasn't.
How do you account for
it? It wasn't glorified. It was just because it's not like the Book of Mormon said, "Thou, Joseph Smith, shalt go and acquire."
I just don't like the word acquire either.
Yeah. Well, he can't. I mean, I don't want you to hear that word and think he forced them.
But even acquired.
But
and selects them and picks them out.
I think he did some of that. I mean, I think he. No, but it was a seduction. And these women, to my knowledge, left on their own free will. Doesn't make it right.
So how does he account for the numerous texts against, you know, adultery in the Bible, which of course the Mormons hold to be true along with their own text? So how does that work?
Great question, and I don't know the answer. Let me take this with a grain of salt because I don't know. But if I were a Mormon, let's say I'm a Mormon and you throw that out at me. I think there is a belief among Mormons that that there are soulmates that are literally fit. They literally are made for each other, in the sense that God actually said, this is the person I want you to be with, in the sort of absolute sense of the term.
In this case, it's not per sin, it's per sons.
Yeah. These are persons that you need to be with. And so the argument would be, well, she was made for me.
And what about marriages to be between one man and one woman?
Where does
not
it say that?
And many women.
Where does it say that in the Bible?
It's got to be a reference somewhere.
Well, in other words, the Bible does allow for polygamous relationships in the Old Testament. Now, of course, the Torah gives an injunction that is almost impossible to follow, and that is, if you are going to do this, you must love your wives equally.
Which is impossible.
So, the New Testament does say that if you're going to be an elder of a church, you have to be the husband of one wife. And that was sort of a subtle way of bringing back monogamous relationships.
I think I'd like to, if I was in conversation with a Mormon, I'd like to bring up David and Bathsheba and ask them how they feel about that story.
That's a very good insight to give.
I mean, just you don't even have to ask them, you know, anything else, but just, well, what do you think about that?
It is interesting, isn't it, though, that like your average Mormon is probably a really upstanding person.
Yeah, I believe that.
And your religion was founded by a total perv. You know? I mean, he's just the guy. Basically, the guy was very thirsty for these women. And he said, why not, you know? It's good to be a prophet.
It doesn't surprise me, but I would like to ask them that and just, you know, see what they're okay. I can see how you can maybe justify, well, David and Solomon, they had multiple wives, so polygamous relationships are okay. Well, you know, I don't agree with that, but that's you know, you'd say it's my interpretation of the text and the times that we're in currently. I don't believe it's healthy to have 200 plus wives and 100 concubines, but they may say, well, David and Solomon did. Okay, fine. But then I'd like to ask them, okay, in the case of your leader, Joseph Smith, if it is true and historically documented that he seduced these women out of their married relationships into a relationship with him.
And now, by the way, this is not every single woman that he married, of course, but there were a few.
If you have documentation of one, all you need is one. And in that case, I would say, okay, is there, you know, let's take a look at the story of David and Bathsheba. Is there a correlation between that story and what Joseph Smith did? And just see what they say.
Sure.
I'd be interested to see what they say and what they think about it. They may say, they could say something like, well,
I'm willing to bet that some of your LDS missionaries, maybe not all, and maybe not even most, but many, Latter-day Saints.
Oh, LDS, okay.
Many of them, Maybe some, if not many, don't even know this. They don't know this about their prophet.
I feel like, I don't know.
The other thing I did want to share, I got a Nephite right, but I think I said Lehite.
Yeah.
And I was wrong. It's the Lamanites.
Lamanites.
So the Nephites were the pure tribe, and the Lamanites were the ones that fell away. Now, by the time they had this big battle, the Nephites have fallen away too. So there's sin that's corrupted both groups. And there were other tribes that broke off from them, but those are the two main ones.
Okay.
But I just want to make sure you got the names right, and that people are listening to this got the names right.
Sure.
All right, so pantheism is our new worldview. This is our third worldview. Theos, of course, means God. Pan means all.
Is there a reason you always go back to the Greek translation for these words? Is that just where these...
That's just where the terms come from. And
words,
so,
words? Okay.
Yeah, and I just wanted to make sure. By the way, etymology does not always determine the meaning of a word.
Oh, Etymology is the study of?
It's the study of the history of its usage.
Okay.
And, you know, you'll look at the root word, and it comes from this, 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 and this. So studying etymology can be fun and interesting, but it can also be deceptive. Just to give you one example, I was watching the debate with Ken Ham and Bill Nye, the science guy. And, they have the Ark exhibition now where you have Ken Ham walking through the Ark with Bill Nye. And as Bill Nye is talking, and he's talking about the great geological ages, and, of course, Ken Ham doesn't believe in any of that stuff. He believes that the universe is 6,000 years old. And Bill Nye is going, well, that just isn't science. Well, Ken Ham says, well, science comes from the Latin scientia, which means knowledge. So do you know that for certain, that these vast geological ages are there, that they actually happened? Well, of course, Bill Nye doesn't know that with absolute certainty. There are very few scientific theories that are known with absolute certainty. That's because they're based on inductive inferences.
So you would disagree with Ken Ham and say that science is not knowledge?
I would say that to define the meaning of a term is determined by its usage and not by its etymology. And so to say that the natural sciences must yield certainty in order to be science, given that Latin etymology, is a bogus line of reasoning. I think that illustrates just a fundamental misunderstanding of what science is.
Didn't we say yesterday that science is kind of based on the predictability of preceding events?
Yeah, that was a couple of days ago, actually, when we looked at agnosticism. David Hume did say that we can't know for sure that the future is going to be like the past. And so how do we ground induction? How do we know that? How do we know that induction? What justifies our belief in induction? And Hume had no answer to that, and so he just went and played backgammon. But my illustration here is just pointing out that here's Ken Ham and Bill Nye. Neither of them are really scientists. I mean, Bill Nye is a popularizer, and so is Ken Ham. But Ken Ham is saying, well, science means knowledge. And so unless you can show me with absolute certainty that these geological ages actually were there, then you've not proven to me that the universe is billions of years old. And I think, you know, Bill Nye didn't really know how to answer that, but I would have said to Ken Ham, you just are showing a fundamental misunderstanding of science. I do think that Bill Nye said that, but I don't think he explained well enough why Ken Ham doesn't understand science.
Can you explain why now?
Oh, yeah, I would say, you're taking the etymology of a term and you're using that to determine exactly how science should operate. And that's just not how it works. I mean, the older term for science is natural philosophy. So in the 17th century, if you were to go back there, and you would hear this term, you'd say, what is a natural philosopher? Well, that's just a person who studies nature. And that was the beginnings of a distinction between philosophy and science. If you go back 100 years or so before Copernicus, there really was no difference between what a philosopher did and what a scientist did. They were all kind of just part of one big stew. Well, by the time we hit the 17th century, there you had these philosophers that were just dwelling more on nature rather than meta-nature, metaphysics, that which is beyond nature. And there's your split. And now this natural philosophy becomes its own thing. So that now we call it science. We used to even call it the natural sciences as opposed to the historical sciences, as opposed to the mathematical sciences, as opposed to the theological sciences. You see, the idea is that God can be known too. And so theology was considered a science because God can be known. Well, now we don't believe that God can be known. Our culture has rejected that. That's why theology departments became religion departments, because religion is what humans do, and theology, you know, is at least indicating that there is a study of God to be had. Well, you can't do that because God is not a knowable being. And so the secular university usually just reserves the word science to natural science. But science in that context refers to the methodology. It doesn't refer to, I know this. It refers to how I acquire a certain knowledge of how the world works. And so when Ken Ham says these kinds of things, he's just illustrating once again how ignorant he is about science. All right, I could go on, but we'll dwell on pantheism. Because pan means all, and because theos means God, we're saying that everything is God, or all is God. Pantheists reduce everything to mine, or the all, or the one. As one might imagine, pantheism comes in several forms. The most broadest, that's great grammar. The broadest and most ancient form of pantheism is Hinduism. The oldest texts expressing the Hindu point of view are the Vedas. That's the holy scriptures of the Hindus. And there are four: the Rig, Sama, Yajur, and Atharva. The Rig Veda has been dated to as early as 1500 BC, even though scholars give it a later date. It is a compilation of over 1,000 prayerful hymns addressed to the various gods, or the devas. You've heard the term diva. She's a diva. That means goddess, right? Many hymns seem to suggest that one particular god is supreme, but in context, a complex and flexible pantheon emerges that shows signs of development even over the period of collection. The four branches of Vedic learning, Rig, Sama, Yajur, and Atharva, consist of two parts, works and knowledge. The first is mainly made up of hymns, instructions regarding rites and ceremonies and rules of conduct. The second is concerned with the knowledge of God, the highest aspect of religious truth, and is called the Upanishads. The Upanishads were written in the 6th century B.C. And it's in the 6th century B.C. where we see a shift, a major shift, from polytheistic Hinduism, or a Hinduism that is almost exclusively polytheistic, to a Hinduism that becomes pantheistic, at least among the intellectuals. And the Upanishads are the commentaries, really, on the Vedas. They are sometimes called Vedanta, which means the supplement to the Vedas. How many were originally written is unknown, but we have 108 of them. And Winfried Corduan observes the following about the Upanishads. He says that although the Upanishads are part of the Vedic literature, their teaching diverges from it somewhat. Whereas the Vedas emphasize priestly rule, the Upanishads seek a deeper spiritual reality. At the heart of Vedantic teaching is the idea that there is only one true reality, namely Brahman. Brahman is God, conceptualized as an impersonal, all-pervasive being. In English, it is sometimes called the world soul. Brahman is infinite, beyond all categories, and beyond all human thought. Brahman is actually all there is. Everything that is not Brahman is not truly real. It is called Maya, which literally means play, and is related to the word magic. The life that we experience day in and day out is simply magical play arising out of Brahman. It does not possess genuine reality. Subsequent Vedantic Hinduism thought of Maya as illusion, though it is not completely necessary to say that Maya has no reality whatsoever. It is sufficient to say that Maya's reality is completely derived from Brahman. Therefore, it is self-destructive to consider Maya as having reality in itself. We may think of Maya as the image created by a movie projector or as a dream, real but insubstantial. If we immerse ourselves in the projection or the dream as genuine reality, we will live in complete ignorance, and this state will keep us from finding true reality. Everything that we experience or think about rationally belongs to Maya. Maya encompasses all physical objects, including our bodies. Our feelings and emotions are Maya. So are our thoughts. Even religion is part of Maya. The gods and their worship are all merely manifestations of Brahman. Thus, there does not seem to be anything trustworthy, for it is all Maya. Deep inside the human soul, however, under all the intellectual, psychological, and religious faculties, there is a reality that is not Maya. It is called Atman, sometimes translated as the true self. It has reality apart from Maya's deceptions, for Atman is identical with Brahman. Thus, in the farthest reaches of the soul, where the true self resides, there is God. Juan Mascaro concurs with Korjuan. He says, we find in the Upanishads the great questions of man, and their answer is summed up in two words, Brahman and Atman. They are two names for one truth, and the two are one and the same. The truth of the universe is Brahman. Our own inner truth is Atman. The sacred Om is the name for both Brahman and Atman, and can be divided into three sounds, but the three roll into one, Aum. One of the meanings of Om is yes. Brahman, Atman, Om is the positive truth, the yes of all. The pantheism inherent in the Hindu scriptures is most apparent in the Mandukya Upanishads, where we read, the syllable Om, which is the imperishable Brahman, is the universe. Whatever has existed, whatsoever exists, whatsoever shall exist hereafter is Om. And whatsoever transcends past, present, and future, that also is Om. All this that we see without is Brahman, this self that is within is Brahman. In the Mundaka Upanishad, we discover that Brahman is all in all. He is action, knowledge, goodness supreme. To know him hidden in the lotus of the heart is to untie the knot of ignorance. Notice that humanity's problem is not moral. It is intellectual. If we would only realize our own divinity, all of our problems would be resolved. Or in the words of the Hindu scriptures, the individual self, deluded by forgetfulness of his identity with the divine self, bewildered by his ego, grieves and is sad. But when he recognizes the worshipful Lord as his own true self and beholds his glory, he grieves no more. When the seer beholds the effulgent one, the Lord, the Supreme Being, then transcending both good and evil and free from impurities, he unites himself with him. So notice that according to the scriptures, God is neither good nor evil. God is beyond such distinctions. This might sound confusing, for how can we understand a being who is neither good nor evil? Are these not mutually exclusive categories? Isn't it impossible to not be good if one is not evil? Surely there is not a third alternative to being good or evil. But at this point, Easterners will accuse the critic of logic chopping and Western imperialism. God is not something that can be known with the mind. One can only intuit God. God cannot be rationally known, for as the Kena Upanishad says, knowing the self to be Brahman, the wise on departing this life become immortal. Him the eye does not see, nor the tongue express, nor the mind grasp. Him we neither know nor are able to teach. Different is he from the known, and different is he from the unknown. So have we heard from the wise. Again, he truly knows Brahman who knows him is beyond knowledge. He who thinks he knows, knows not. The ignorant think that Brahman is known, but the wise know him to be beyond all rational knowledge.
Sounds contradictory.
Stop thinking that way. You're not allowed to take your Western imperialistic mind and impose that on the all. The all is far greater than you.
Then how can even the intellectuals know it?
Well, they don't know it rationally. They've intuited.
The wise know him to be beyond rational knowledge. Therefore, they have some knowledge of him. Where does that knowledge come from?
Intuition. As I said before, we intuit God. We don't rationally comprehend him.
Okay, well, define what intuition means in this case, then.
Feeling.
Feeling.
The reason your life is so screwed up is because you don't really understand the divine self within. But how do you get to that? Well, you get that through meditation practices like yoga. Yoga means union or to yoke. So when you're engaged in meditation, you are yoking your soul with Atman or Brahman. So the journey is not without. The journey is within. And so I meditate and I contemplate the Atman or the Om. And that's when I fully realize my union with Brahman. And so all yoga meditation practices are meant to get you to that point where you recognize your own divinity. And when you see that, when you have that moment of clarity, then all of the things of this world become sort of, as the hymn says, strangely dim in the light of my glory and grace. You see. How are we doing?
Good.
Is this good? Or is this...
Yes, I am understanding it.
Okay. Now, the most important Hindu philosopher in history is Shankara. Okay, because he gave us probably the purest form of pantheism. Okay. While most pantheists wanted to ascribe some sort of limited or secondary reality with respect to the pantheistic one, Shankara insisted that all is one in Brahman, and hence everything else is illusion. And so he is the quintessential proponent of Advaita Vedanta Hinduism. Advaita is the term for non-dualism. All is one. And he gives no qualifications to this. Distinctions are an illusion. And so Shankara says, in the same way as those arts of ethereal space which are limited by jars and water pots are not really different from the universal ethereal space, so this manifold world with its objects of enjoyment, enjoyers, and so on, has no existence apart from Brahman. The reader is not to interpret the last phrase theistically. That is, it's not as though Shankara believed that God causes the universe to exist and as nothing exists apart from God. Rather, everything we see is one in Brahman. Any sense of distinction that comes to us must be an illusion. Brahman is that whose nature is permanent purity, intelligence, and freedom. It constitutes the inward self of all. Of this Brahman, our Upanishadic text denies all plurality of forms, but Brahman itself it leaves untouched. The clause, not so, not so, negatives or negates, and not absolutely everything, but only everything but Brahman. Now, there's an emanational or multi-level pantheism that comes from Sarvapalli Radhakrishnan. He died in 1975. So he's a more modern philosopher. Shankara dies in the year 820 or thereabouts. So I'm skipping over a lot. But I'm just giving some representatives of pantheism. And Radhakrishnan insists that there are different layers of reality, all of which manifest God in one way or another. And so Radhakrishnan's philosophy also may be called multi-level or manifestational pantheism, because the unity of the Supreme is manifested or expressed in and through the lower orders of being. In fact, some quotations of Radhakrishnan imply certain panentheistic leanings in his thought. So I've wrestled with whether to put him in the panentheistic camp or the pantheistic camp.
Because this is, he expressed some distinction between God and the world. So pantheism would say that
there's no distinction.
All that we are experiencing, seeing, everything here is, in other words, an illusion created by Brahman.
Yes, an illusion created by my mind, really.
But given to us by Brahman.
Brahman is...
products of that.
Yeah. Okay. There's a Hindu myth that goes something like this. Brahman fell asleep, and he had a dream, and that dream was the beginning of the universe and the universe's history that follows after it. And you and I are just the dream of Brahman. Now, one day he's going to wake up, and the universe is going to end.
It's a long nap.
It's a very long nap. And then he's going to fall back to sleep again, and then we're going to find ourselves right here again having this conversation. Have you ever experienced deja vu?
Yeah.
I've been here before. Well, you have been here before. Because there are only so many ways Brahman can dream. And so after so many trillions of years, he re-dreams the same dream. So there we are. We're just living out.
Instantaneously.
It makes the term living the dream, he gives it a whole new meaning, right? All right. So here's a quotation from Radha Krishnan where he gives his 2 cents worth on God. He says, then he gives a bogus objection against Hinduism. And he says, to the Hindu, ethical rules are meaningless because the world is divine. Everything is God, and there is no excuse for interfering with the sacred activities of the pickpocket and the perjurer. The critic believes that he refutes the theory of divine immanence associated with all forms of Indian thought when he exclaims, it's Piccadilly Circus God, it's Hyde Park Corner God, these are places in London. The Hindu views rebels against the cold and formal conception of God who is external to the world and altogether remote and transcendent. The natural law of the world is but the working of God's sovereign purpose. The uniformity of nature, the orderliness of the cosmos, and the steady reaching forward and upward of the course of evolution proclaim not the unconscious throbbing of a soulless engine, but the directing mind of an all-knowing spirit. The indwelling of God in the universe does not mean the identity of God with the universe. See the distinction there? The Hindu thought takes care to emphasize the transcendent character of the Supreme. He bears the world, but is by no means lost in it. The world is in God and not God in the world. In the universe, we have the separate existence of individuals. Whether the divine spark burns dimly or brightly in the individual, the sparks are distinct from the central fire from which they issue. Since the phrase Radha Krishnan quotes, God bears the world, but he is no means lost in it, is not referenced, it is hard to know whether it is correctly interpreted or he is correctly interpreting the passage. It is possible that it comes from the Upanishads, in which case it probably means, given everything we have already seen, that no individual fact in the cosmos can possibly exhaust Brahman. Unfortunately, Radha Krishnan does not give us a reference to the quotation, and so we're left with little more than speculation. That said, the reader should appreciate Radha Krishnan's desire to see distinctions within things and between things. Every layer of reality, you, me, the tree, the plant, even inanimate things like rocks and sand, have the divine spark residing within it. The only difference is one of degree. While there is nothing which is not lit by God, God is more fully revealed in the organic than in the inorganic, he says, more in the conscious than the unconscious, more in man than in the lower creatures, more in the good man than in the evil. But even the worst of the world cannot be dismissed as completely undivine, fit only to be cast into hellfire. All right. That would be the East. Now we turn to Western monism. What is monism? It comes from the word mono, which means one. So everything reduces to the one. All forms of pantheism are a species of metaphysical monism, which is not an entirely Eastern phenomenon. Perhaps the greatest of the monistic philosophers coming out of the West is Plotinus. But Western monism does not begin with him. Indeed, the pre-Socratic philosophers of ancient Greek, Thales, Anaximander, Anaximenes, Pythagoras, Heraclitus, and so forth, they were all exclusively monistic. Unfortunately, they could never agree with each other on what the one is. Is it water? Aferon? What is Aferon? It means boundless. What is boundless? I don't know. It's boundless. Air? Could the one be air? Is it number? Is it fire? They couldn't agree. Perhaps the greatest of the pre-Socratic philosophers is Parmenides. And while he left us with very few writings, there is enough from him to reconstruct what is quite possibly the most important argument for monism in the history of thought. Now, this is an argument that actually proves pantheism or proves monism. So my question to you is, how do you refute it? You ready? Here's the rendition of the argument, followed by a brief defense and commentary. Everything that exists is a being. Would you agree with that?
Is a being. Well, what's the definition of being?
Something that is. Parmenides would put it like this, whatever is, is. By the way, that's what made him famous. He said, whatever is, is.
Everything that exists is a being.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
I'm a being, you're a being. There's a being right there, that podium.
Being would, I guess, just be magic.
A being is just something that is.
Okay.
Right? Things differ in either being or non-being. Something or nothing. If I'm going to be different from you, I mean, I'm either going to differ in something or I'm going to differ in nothing.
Okay.
If they differ in nothing, then there's no difference between them.
Okay.
If they differ in being or they differ in something, then they differ in what they have in common. But premise four, the idea that we differ in what we have in common, is absurd, for to differ in what is held in common is not to differ at all. There are no differences between things. Everything is the same thing, and that means that monism is true. How are we doing?
Okay, six. There are no differences between things, so there's no difference between... See, I like the distinction in what's made by Radhakrishna between organic and inorganic
mm-hmm.
materials.
And Parmenides would say that that's an illusion.
That's an illusion.
Yeah. Shankara would smile, and he would agree with Parmenides over against Radhakrishna.
And saying that you're no different from this wood pew that I'm sitting on.
Yes. Now, if you say to me, but I'm experiencing the difference, Parmenides would say, logic trumps empiricism here.
Well, this pew cannot achieve optimum. So,
how do you know that?
Is that not a difference?
This pew is one with me who is Atman, and therefore it has achieved it.
But you, it's an extension of you. It requires you to therefore have that, because
it's not an extension of me. There's just no distinction between us to be had.
The pew doesn't have an inner soul.
Well, the pew has nothing less than I have, because any distinction between us is an illusion. So if you look at me and say, well, the pew doesn't have a soul, the pew is not you, if you keep saying that stuff, I'm going to say, what do you do with this argument? I differ. There's a difference between me and this pew, and if there's a difference, rather, between me and this pew, that difference is either in nothing or something. But it can't be in nothing, because then there'd be no difference, and there can't be in something, because then that means we differ in what we have in common, which is bogus. So there's no difference between me and the pew.
Sounds circular.
Well, all you have to do is refute premise two. Everything that differs in either.
This refutes itself, then.
Huh?
This rendition refutes itself.
How?
How can you say two is true, things differ in either being or non-being, and then also say that six, there are no differences between things?
Well, how about this? We could put an if clause in the in two and say if things are to differ, they're going to differ in nothing or something.
But there's not an if clause in here.
Yeah, but if that's what that means, though. Things are going to differ. This is a reductio ad absurdum. And in reductio ad absurdum arguments, you basically just, you're reducing a position to an absurdity. And so you accept two for the sake of argument. And you take it to its logical conclusion. And you conclude in premise five that the idea that things differ is absurd. And that's why six follows. There are no differences between things. So everything that exists is the same.
Well, if you go back to the earlier point on the fact that these gentlemen could not agree on what one is.
Yeah, but those are them. This is Parmenides. He's saying, he comes after these guys and he says, well...
It still doesn't define what one is.
It doesn't matter.
Well, why doesn't it matter?
Well, I mean, you could say that all is mind. Or, you know... that they're
all is mind, all is thought, but the pew doesn't have thought.
Yeah, but the differences that you're trying to conjure up is that those are established empirically. And he's pointing out that the logic works. And so to come up to him and say, but I differ from you, or you differ from that sand over there, he would smile and say, yeah, but you're using your senses to make that point. I'm pointing out that monism is true, your senses be damned. Your senses have deceived you before. Maybe they're deceiving you now when it notes distinctions between things.
Well, how can he state this? How can he know that?
Because of the logic, because of the argument. He's proven that all is one. Let me give some commentary. The first point to notice is that the proof is purely rational or conceptual. Parmenides does not prove the unity of all things by appealing to facts established through sensation. Rather, he looks within himself, finds himself having the notion of being, and then infers that all is one being. Second, notice that the proof works only if the senses cannot be trusted, for clearly the senses tell us the reality is diverse and not one. Third, the argument is valid. If a non-monist wants to avoid the conclusion, he must offer another premise, or at least a revised premise, that is A, at least possibly true, and B, stops the flow of the argument. That's your goal. Find a premise that is possibly true and stops the flow of the argument. And finally, the only way to stop the flow of the argument in a way that can satisfy the monist is to appeal to a logically possible proposition, one originating the mind. One cannot appeal to the facts of experience without begging the question. So if you go, look, man, you and I are different because we had these experiences. He's going to go, dude, I trumped sensation with this argument. So to do a true answer to him, you got to get in his mind and show him where he went wrong in his reasoning. You can't just point out, because he's going to recognize, he knows. He's sitting back and smiling at all the people that are going, look at the sand, it doesn't think. We think, and we're organic, and that stuff doesn't move around. He knows all that. He's not a moron, right? He's a very intelligent man. So he knows all that, but his point is that reason, pure reason, proves that all is one. And that means that all of the diversity we're experiencing is just an illusion. In fact, his student, Zeno, actually came up with paradoxes to show that we never even move. Zeno's paradox was like
moving infinitely from point A to point B.
Yeah, point A to point B. Yeah, exactly. Zeno's paradox is to get to from point A to point B, I got to get to the middle of that. But to get to that, I get to the middle of that. And so there's an infinite distance between point A and point B, and therefore I'm never really making it. And so the paradox is that I am. So how do you solve that? Well, Zeno would follow his master and say, the movement, motion is an illusion. All right. Another Western philosopher who developed the pantheistic worldview is Plotinus. He is the last of the great Greek philosophers. He taught that there is a source or a one from which everything flows, and which stands behind all that exists. To give a summary of his thought, I quote a couple of Christian philosophers who say that the ancients thought that the sun could shine forth its light without reducing its own reality. In the same way, the one overflows as the world, but is not reduced in any way by this emanation. The world, therefore, can be thought of as a reflection of the one. In a famous passage, Plotinus says this. He says, the one is all things and no one of them. The source of all things is not all things, and yet it is all things in a transcendent sense. All things, so to speak, having run back to it, or more correctly, not all as yet are within it. They will be. Hence, Plotinus draws some distinction between the one and everything else that flows from it, but the distinction here is not in kind, but in degree. The one is not being, but it is not non-being either. It is that which is beyond any positive intellectual description. But when the intellectual principle is produced, and we must always keep in mind this is an eternal production, it is being. Plotinus then writes, soul arises out of the motionless intellectual principle, which itself sprang from its own motionless prior. But the soul's operation is not similarly motionless. Its image is generated from its movement. It takes fullness by looking to its source, but it generates its image by adopting another, a downward movement. The soul then manifests itself in body, which in turn manifests itself in matter, that which borders on pure potentiality or absolute nothingness. What in the heck is he saying? How do I get myself out of this? Let me give you a principle that is, we're going to be talking about this in another context within the next couple of weeks. And this is a principle that came out of Pantheus. And it was used to destroy the theistic doctrine of creation. And so this is actually a very important point, because you have Christians running around now getting all upset about evolution and the age of the universe and all of that stuff. And the fact of the matter is, the real heart of the issue is whether the universe came from nothing but the power of God. And the pantheists destroyed the Judeo-Christian doctrine of creation long ago by appealing to a principle. And this is really what Plotinus is getting at. The good is naturally diffusive of itself.
The good, what is the good?
Well, the good is what is desired for its own sake. And what is truly good is automatically, naturally diffusive of itself. Now, what does that mean? I'll quote Jonathan Edwards, who said, It does not point to an imperfection in a fountain when you note that it naturally overflows or has a tendency to overflow. Right? So you look at a fountain and the water's overflowing on the fountain. It's not an imperfection of the fountain that it has a tendency to overflow. It's not an imperfection of the good that has a tendency to overflow. Now, what do I mean to further develop this? If you think about it, a good man wants to have his goodness shared with another. So if you're rich and you're good, you will share your wealth with others. Right?
Okay.
And so that would be an illustration of how we think the good is naturally diffusive of itself. If you find a rich man that doesn't want to share his wealth, that is actually our definition of a bad rich man. A miser, a Scrooge, you see. Or a good teacher naturally wants to communicate his truth to others. Right? A good musician naturally wants to share that goodness with other people. The good music that's in his soul, he wants to deliver it. Or a good singer naturally wants that good to diffuse out to a crowd so that they can appreciate the beauty of his or her voice. So this is just a natural philosophical intuition. Now, if you agree with me that the good is naturally diffusive of itself, then that means that if there is a God, God must create. Because God is driven to create, because God is wholly good, and God is going to therefore naturally have to create the universe. And that means that the universe is just as necessary as God is.
Well, I would disagree with you in that I believe maybe that we have the capability to be good, but that we also have equally the capability to be not good.
Yes, but God does not have that capability. God does not have the capability to be not good. God is wholly good and all good. And therefore, since God is all good, creation naturally flows out of God. And this is why you should be a pantheist and not a theist, because if the good is naturally diffusive of itself, then God must create. And therefore, the idea of free creation, which is what Christians and Jews have traditionally believed, is false, because the universe must exist, because it must flow out of God's being. And so the pantheist says that God creates out of himself. And so what Plotinus is really getting at is this, The universe is to be likened to the rock that is thrown into the pond. That very central point is the one. And then there's something that naturally flows out of the one, which is the intellectual principle. And there's something that naturally flows out of that, and that, and that, until you get to almost that which borders on nothing, and that is matter. And then, if it's a wavy lake, you see the circles running back into each other. And so all is flowing naturally out of God, almost like cascading down from a river or whatever. There's always a natural flow from a source to everything else. How are we doing?
Good. I guess my question going back then to this good that is able to be diffused, you said?
The good is naturally diffusive of itself.
Naturally diffusive of itself, okay. Well, who establishes good? Or does it always just exist?
Good is eternal and unchanging.
As equally as God?
Well, the good is God. There's no distinctions, remember?
Okay.
And by the way, traditionally, theists have held that because they hold to the simplicity of God. There's no distinction between God and His goodness. God is the good. And the pantheists would say, right, and therefore you have to reject your theism and you must become a pantheist because since the good is naturally diffusive of itself, God must create.
Isn't that theory, isn't it dependent on the existence of one God?
Yeah, there's only one God.
But that theory of good, it's dependent on there actually being one God from
yeah.
whom this good then overflows.
Yes.
So would you say then that that's not self-sufficient? It requires the belief in one God.
Well, there's one God, and that is the pantheistic one. And from that pantheistic one, all things overflow.
So is that
so? You and I are the.
Is that not then a combination of theism and pantheism?
No, you can't be a consistent theist. Is the point? You can't be a theist because you can't because your God is infinite, and because God is infinitely good, that means that God must create. And that means that the universe is just as necessary as God is. It's on a lower level, like the circle leaving the center, but it's still part of that whole process. And therefore, God can't be conceived of as personal. God must be the impersonal one from which all things flow. And that's why there's a divine spark in all of us. And so your problem is you're ignorant of your own divinity. If you would just realize that all this, you know, this religion that you've conjured up for yourself, that's been sort of forced on you by your parents and others, if you would just realize that is all illusory, then you would actually be a happier person. What time do we have now?
Ten oh three.
All right, so we're going to stop right here. So we've had a good 55 minutes. I want you to think about these arguments for pantheism. And then we will get back on this on Monday. So also make sure you watch What the Bleep Do We Know. So that's it.